WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
That I've given a short
blurb,
so to speak, yes. And I will mention the title and publisher and all that of your new book.
I don't mind if you don't.
Oh, but I will. Okay. Were there any occurrences in your life that led to reflection on sex and birth control and the family in your new book?
All of the occurrences in my life, I suppose, tended towards that. But some of them predate the female eunuch, which is what people seem to have forgotten. They forget that they ridiculed me for saying in the female eunuch that I didn't really feel I could bring up a child in our society, and that if I ever was going to have a child, I would like to bring it up in Calabria, which was a part of the world I got to know in 1966. Everybody's completely forgotten that they excreted all over me for this outlandish idea. And I guess because I've got a kind of suicide instinct, I went along that direction. Why did I feel that way, and was there any real reason for my feeling that way? Then there were things like World Population Year. That was a big shock and an eye-opener to me. Then there was the struggles I had with the feminist movement when I tried to get them to condemn the way we were marketing family planning in developing countries. And they gave me a terrific runaround. Because they just couldn't see it. They thought that women needed to be rescued from childbearing, whether they want to be rescued from childbearing or not, which to me seemed so unfeminist a position. And I tried to get them to run an editorial in Spare Rib. This was even before World Population Year. This, I think, was in 1973. Now, it's funny because given all this talk of a great volte-face, I'm putting together a volume of essays in chronological order. And I've realized just how long I've held these views. I wouldn't have said that this struggle with spare rib was as early as 73, but I think from the evidence that that's when it happened. Because, you see, the feminists couldn't see it at all. They really thought of childbearing as a sort of scourge that women had to be saved from. That was partly because of their age group. I mean, if you're in your early 20s, you think pregnancy is kind of just around the corner all the time. When you get to be 35, you realize it's beginning to recede into the distance. It was partly a function of that, but also a function of their utter unawareness of alternative social structures and the roles of women within them.
Your new book has been interpreted in many articles as being in sharp contrast to the female eunuch. It's been perceived that the female eunuch helped create the sexual revolution, and that this is reversing that opinion by saying, by recommending abstinence or self-control as a form of birth control. Do you see yourself as having reversed positions?
No, actually. I mean, if you remember, in the female eunuch, there's a sentence that says that the permissive society has made of heterosex rather a sorry affair. And I never was impressed by the sex manuals. They seemed to me to be mechanical and cold and vulgar. I mean, there was no idea of building up the mental tension, which is what makes psychosexual release really satisfying. There was no talk about how to make love to people really. It was all about what to do when you got there. And the assumption was you'd get there pretty easily because everyone was standing around waiting for a chance to do it. It wasn't my idea that vibrators should be a growth industry. I mean, I'm really saddened to read in England, you know, that their sales figures for 1983 were 110,000 vibrators in a country with 50 million people, including old people and children. That seems to me like an awful lot of gadgetry, you know. And that has, in my mind, nothing to do with freedom. Freedom has to do with understanding your own sexuality and not allowing it to be debased. That means not seeing your sexual activity as something that's forced on you, whether it be to say no or whether it be to say yes, you see. So there's no big change about that. What was really the spur behind my wanting to take the stigma of chastity? I mean, we think that chastity is a sort of disease. You'll go crazy, you know, you'll be, because your circuits haven't been unjammed, you're going to be in serious trouble. I used to lecture to American college students in 72, 71, 72, 73, in order to pay my tax debt, actually, in England. I had to do a lot of it. And my subject was feminism and fertility. And I would listen to these young women complaining about their contraceptive regimens, just going on and on. And then I would say to them, but look, you've made yourself, from being a well young woman, you've made yourself into a rather sick young woman. You've had major surgery, you've had a brush with thromboembolism, which is not funny, and so on and so forth. Now isn't it time to start asking yourself, is it worth it? And they look at me as if to say, what do you mean? So is the sex itself, is what you are doing with your lover worth the risk you are taking to be able to do it? More consternation. Of course it is. That's how we're supposed to live, isn't it? So then I'd say, well, look, you know, you're supposed to be able to have orgasms by all kinds of stimulation. Masters and Johnson proved that. You don't have to have a penis inside there. You don't have to have ejaculation taking place inside there to have your orgasm. And your psychosexual satisfaction is going to come from all the things surrounding it as much as from what is actually done. So maybe what you should be thinking is that you want to have a different kind of sex. If you don't want to have children, why do you have to imitate the act of fathering children when you make love? That in any other context, that would be neurotic. If what you want to do is eat, and you go around with things in your mouth all the time, it's an obvious piece of, you know, replacement activity. So, and I tried to suggest that human beings have enough imagination, and also taking a week off every now and then is not going to cause a relationship to crumble, unless, of course, the relationship's no good in the first place. And that seemed to me to be the basic anxiety. I felt that if I really said to them, when all the chips were down, are you sure that what he likes is you and not it? The answer would have to be, well, frankly, I'm not, and I'm frightened. If I get difficult, he'll find someone easier. Now, that is not freedom. And I guess if I want one woman to be difficult on this issue, I want us all to be difficult. I want us to say, uh-uh. We were accessible all through the 70s, and it got us nowhere. It made us sick. And I don't think the orgasm count went up significantly, actually. We'll never know, of course. So really, I think the sexual revolution didn't happen. And I really resent having people credit me with what Hugh Hefner did. I mean, Hugh Hefner was the marketer of sexual opportunity. He sold it to 8 million people every month with all the gloss at his command. I never did that. And I never believed that what he was doing was the right thing. I did cooperate with Playboy because I wanted to talk to the however many million people, 24 million people are supposed to have read each issue of Playboy. I wanted to talk to them. I wanted to suggest some ideas that might not have occurred to them. And I think a lot of people took that as meaning that I belonged in that camp and I would one of these days appear on a gatefold or something. But I never belonged in that camp. I was using a very long spoon.
Well, throughout history, since people have known about the connection between intercourse and pregnancy, there have been attempts to try to separate the two. And now we have technology to help us do it, and spermicides, chemicals, things like that. Now, some people have a moral difference with that and think that morally or religiously you shouldn't separate the two. That's not what you're saying. You're just worried about the chemicals that people are using and the health hazards that modern birth control presents.
Well, I'm also sort of disheartened by convenient sex. If you actually talk to 16-year-olds in England, they seem to live in a sort of twilight culture. They, as far as sex is concerned, they don't know what all the fuss was about. They're rather disgusted with the kerfuffle that their parents made over what they regard as a very simple activity. I mean, it's partly to upset their parents that people like Johnny Rotten would say, oh, sex, what's that? I'd rather have a cup of tea. Sex is just 2.5 minutes squelching. And he recently announced that he'd extended it. He'd been in therapy and been able to extend the squelching to 5 minutes. But, I mean, the use of the word squelching was just a way of mocking the extreme reverence of the older generation for what the kids regard as, you know, a pretty blah activity. I think they think that fighting is more fun. Lots of groups have thought in the past, of kids have thought that fighting was more fun than hanging on to bits of each other in the lift or whatever they were up to doing. And there was a strange little thing in the News of the World, which has no brief for me, would not knowingly ratify anything that I said, where 5 girls who were on the pill were discussing their sexual activity, and they all sort of said, well, oh, yeah, you know, the first time was boring, but, you know, they expect you to do it. We do it. It's pretty boring. It's no great deal. And one girl said, well, I never say no to anybody because, you know, I'm on the pill, and why be difficult? And I thought, oh, God, if anyone thinks that I have anything to do with this state of affairs, I want to dissociate myself. That is not freedom. That is taking the line of least resistance, which is the expression that I've used in this book to describe the whole oral contraceptive culture. I mean, oral contraceptives, if you like, are the pharmacological agent of female castration, which is what the female eunuch was actually about. We still don't know what women's sexuality is. And that's why I've made this revolutionary suggestion in this book that a large part of female sexuality is connected with contact with babies who are hugely more sexy than grown-up men, who are sexy right down to the tips of their little tiny fingernails, and that maybe we want to keep that residue of pleasure. It's a really limitless pleasure compared to the sort of thrill of orgasm. I mean, the pleasure that women who are turned on to babies get from babies is oceanic. A lot of women, of course, in our society are not turned on to babies at all, and that's another problem. A lot of women don't feel anything when they suckle. I had a girlfriend who used to smoke a cigarette and read a mystery story while one of my godchildren tugged away at the breast, which always struck me as taking blasé behavior to fairly extreme lengths.
Well, one of the reasons for saying no to sex before was that it could make you pregnant if you weren't married to somebody or if you were a teenager. Now that there's birth control, if you have access to it, you can't use that anymore. Are you saying that women don't feel that they have any valid excuses to say no to a sexual invitation?
They don't have any reasons which are not productive of anger in the partner. You see, the fear of pregnancy was mutual, and it meant that you had to take a rest every now and then, or you had to think of doing something else. Now, you see, I think women probably quite often want something else to be done, of various kinds, oral sex, for example. I mean, I don't particularly like it, but lots of women seem to not be able to get enough of it. That's to do with our sexual culture. What is our culture like? The whole fantasy that white men have in North America that maybe blacks have a different kind of sexier sex than they have. And in the old days, oral sex, for example, was almost exclusively connected with minority groups in North America. WASPs didn't do that kind of stuff. So it seems to me that maybe we should be thinking, okay, destroying fertility, even temporarily, is not smart. Men won't tolerate it at all, and it doesn't seem to do women any good. So maybe what we should be thinking is, gee, wow, yes, I am an unexploded bomb. I contain China within me, if I'm a man, you know. Or if you're a woman, I contain babies within me. Maybe we should be thinking that we should make love to each other in a way that takes cognizance of that fact. While pleasuring each other, which we can do in hundreds of ways, we don't, as it were, defy fertility. By insisting on making love like the founding fathers, with impunity, i.e. insisting on intromission and intravaginal ejaculation, by doing that, we're sort of flouting our own fertility, ignoring it or punishing it in some way. Maybe we should do it something else. I'm not for chastity. What I'm really for, if anybody can read intelligently, is perversion. We accept it in homosexual groups. We say, yes, they do. They're never going to ejaculate in a vagina. We don't feel sorry for them because they're not going to do it. We understand that they don't want to do it, and they'd be very startled to discover themselves doing it in the case of male homosexuals. So why not? If the concept of normal sex is inapplicable to gay groups, why is it such a burden for heterosexual groups? Because that's what causes women to have to take all the gadgets and the pills and everything else. See? So I'm not for chastity. But I would say, where you have a culture that relies upon chastity and dignity and clothing the naked, which is one of the big appeals of Islam to tribal people, for example, who are exploited in their nakedness, when you have a culture like that, don't sneer at it, because you really don't understand the sexual economy that underlies what you see as simple repression. It's easier for people who have had thousands of years of sexual restraint to continue to practice it than to cope with our technology, which is wrong for them anyway, and our set of values, which is commercial and, you know, instant gratification and so on. These populations could not survive if they were as comfort-seeking as rich North Americans, because that is not available in their environment. And if we arrive there and say, you people are all screwed up, you just don't know how much fun there is to be had in the world, take this oral contraceptive and see what fun you can have, we're doing something really infantile, in my view. Infantile and extremely arrogant.
My guest is Germaine Greer, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, Sex and Destiny. One assumption that I think your argument makes is that people would find alternatives to sexual intercourse as gratifying as intercourse.
Well, and remember that intercourse is a very vague word. Intercourse means any sexual interaction.
I mean...
Intromission, you mean.
Right.
Putting it in there, you
right.
mean. Well, that's the other problem, you see, because people can be acculturated to enjoy all kinds of things, clearly, or we would not have the paraphilias that we do have. It's true that we've got used to doing it a particular way. I'm a girl of the 50s. I'm used to being wooed. I'm used to a large amount of foreplay because I went through 10 years of foreplay. And I'm then used to doing what I call, you know, the D.H. Lawrence number, waiting for the earth to move and all that. And the earth hasn't moved yet, but I figure one of these days maybe it will. So I do tend to pay the price for intromission. But in terms of history and anthropology, there is no earthly reason why we could not acculturate ourselves in a different way. For example, coitus interruptus can be highly sexy. It can be sexier, depending how it is carried out and what kind of a fuss is made about it. If you remember, it was a staple of Scandinavian pornography in the early days when the only kind we could get was Scandinavian. There were all these endless pictures of ejaculation in all sorts of peculiar places, on buttocks and in hair and between breasts and so on. And that was all thought of as extremely horny, except not to do, just to look in the pictures. We can change our attitude to those things very easily. It takes very little. It's one of the most susceptible areas of human behavior to a change in cultural emphasis. Masters and Johnson noticed themselves watching women in the clinical situation. They could produce all kinds of conditioned responses using very slight pressures.
You suggest coitus interruptus as one valid form of birth control in your book, but there is a pretty high rate a failure with that method of birth control. I'm not sure what the percentage is, but...
You mustn't express it in a percentage. Let me explain.
Okay, but two things. First of all, that a lot of women have gotten pregnant on that method. Mm. And second of all, the woman is then dependent on the man's
true
good judgment, good timing, mm-hmm, and honesty.
And affection, tenderness and care. Yes, all of those things. I agree with all
and
of that.
The woman's completely out of control as far as controlling her own fertility.
That depends. It depends where you're coming from. If what you want is a baby, you've got another form of control. The thing is that I do not recommend coitus interruptus. What I'm trying to do is explain a historical situation. The birth rate in Europe fell before any decent technological apparatus was available. There was a vast rubber goods market, but it was used by a minority of people. That itself would not have explained the overall phenomenon of the fall in the birth rate. And there are demographic studies to show that fertility fluctuates wildly. In the famous study by Wrigley of the town called Colleton in Devon, he found that when things were going badly, people didn't have babies. When things were going well, they produced babies because they thought that they could get away with it. They had sufficient resource base to be able to permit themselves a child. And he concluded they were doing something. The most likely thing for them to be doing, they're all agricultural people, they know perfectly well that if the stallion breaks from the mare before he ejaculates, they're not going to have a foal. I mean, it's pretty obvious. So it seems that's probably what they were doing. Now, it also seems that it doesn't work in many communities. Let me suggest a community that is extremely guilty about sex, that has very little experience with lovemaking or caressing, that is apt to have extremely maladroit couplings, usually under the influence of alcohol. You'll probably get 100 letters to the station if I say, take, for example, Ireland, but we're not 100 miles from the mark if we say Ireland. I mean, anthropological and sexological studies have made this clear about some aspects of Irish sexual culture. In Ireland, coitus interruptus is a no-no. It's never going to work. So that you get very bad reports. They try and make it work, but it doesn't work. It has to be part of an ethos of coitus interruptus. And I tried to explain why in Italy, which has a lower birth rate than England, something that people in Philadelphia would be very surprised to hear, it has, their birth rate is 1.59, ours is 1.79 or something like that. It's principally done by this method. But the way in which young people learn to do it is extremely gradual and is buttressed by all kinds of stable social structures that we don't have. You cannot go to a singles bar and demand coitus interruptus. You won't get it. Or you might get an attempt at it that won't work. Now, when it comes to assessing effectiveness of contraceptive methods, you must never listen to anybody who talks to you in percentages because it doesn't make sense. If somebody, the most unfavorable study done is one that American doctors like to quote, which gives a failure rate in coitus interruptus of 35. Now, what that 35 is 35 pregnancies per 100 women years of use. That's how it's calculated. If you turn that into a percentage, if you say it's only 66% or 65% likely to work, that means that every third instance will produce a pregnancy, which makes it rather more effective than actual intercourse. I mean, that's the idea you give people. That's not how it goes. It means that if you practice it for 3 years, you're likely to get one pregnancy in the course of the 3 years. And that's an unfavorable study done against North American conditions, which are not favorable. If you go to other studies done in conditions where it has been used as a part of the culture for a very long time, you get it being on a par, especially amongst educated groups, with the barrier methods, around about 8 pregnancies per 100 women years, which means you could do it for 12 years and you get one pregnancy. Now, the argument about coitus interruptus is contingent upon the availability of a cheap, non-traumatic, accessible pregnancy termination service, which I refuse to countenance the leaving of that out of any discussion of family planning. It must be there.
You're talking about abortion?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
That old thing.
Before we get to abortion, let's just step back a bit.
Let me say a bit about the feminist argument. I've left one aspect of that out. The feminist thing is interesting because the early feminists, some of the old feminists have started writing to me now that I came out with this forbidden stuff about coitus interruptus, and they have said, you know, my mother was a suffragette and I was a feminist, and we've never been able to understand why the young feminists do not demand this kind of attention and respect from the men they go with. We think it's very strange that they're prepared to take extreme measures that affect their own health, and they will not ask for what we took as of right. I can see the feminist difficulty, but I think in terms of a long-standing relationship between sophisticated people who are also interested in things like how their fertility really works, it is not to be discounted.
Before we write off birth control, what's wrong? Okay, the pill is very controversial, though. I've heard a lot of groups say that the dosages are lower than they once were.
Oh, yes, they are.
And it's not as dangerous.
We don't actually know that.
Okay, take the diaphragm, though, which is a barrier method. There's a spermicide, a chemical spermicide that's used. There have been very, very few negative results that have shown up in medical studies. What would your objection to a method like the diaphragm for birth control be before, you know, reverting to something like coitus interruptus?
Well, you see, what I find unacceptable about the diaphragm is the fact that no one has ever done anything to improve it. The diaphragm is this ridiculous piece of rubber, which, by the way, is not as good as it used to be because the rubber's not as good as it used to be. So it smells horrible, and it stains easily. Also, you've got to keep washing it and drying it and putting it away or whatever you decide to do with it. It's always hanging around to the great edification of casual visitors who find it on the faucet in the bathroom or whatever. Also, you see, why do we not have disposable diaphragms? Diaphragms that dissolve, diaphragms we can throw away. Why are we lugging around this ridiculous piece of apparatus, which, you know, looks like a prosthesis or something? Also, the spermicide, the volume of spermicide we have to use is unacceptable to me. The way it smells and tastes is unacceptable to me. The way it feels, it doesn't seem to matter what you do, it never warms up, or at least it sort of warms up right towards the end. And then, of course, if you have interrupted or intermittent intercourse, you've got the whole moral problem of when do you put in some more of the glop? When does one instance of intercourse end and another instance begin? I never knew the answer to that question. And so you could end up, as I said in the book, you know, sort of lovemaking becomes a kind of spermicidal bath. Also, it depends on the spermicide. The mythology is that they can put all kinds of toxins in that gunge and we will not absorb it into our bloodstream. Well, we now know that that's complete nonsense. I mean, men using a testosterone cream in France to restore their erections after they were given a male contraceptive, they could not stop the women growing hair on their faces. And this is a minute trace of testosterone that was put on the penis in the morning. And they made love in the evening, 16 hours away from the application of the cream. And the women still showed these marked signs of testosterone pollution of their systems. So I really don't think that all that stuff lying around in there is terribly good for you, apart from the fact that it's anesthetic. What happens to oral sex if you've got all that muck in there? I mean, lovemaking goes on and takes many forms and goes through many phases. It imposes a kind of uniformity on the act, and that, again, I don't like, because of the emphasis on intromission. If you read the directions, they assume that sex is normal sex will be 1, 2, 3, out, finish, goodbye, good night, whatever. And all that stuff, you know, you're not supposed to douche, you're supposed to take it out in the morning. Well, who said you were having sex in the night? What do you do if you're making love in the open? What do you do with your diaphragm at the beach? And I can never keep the damn thing in my fingers anyway. It usually flies out and splatters the bathroom with muck. And I sort of scrabble around trying to... And also there's the question of insertion during or just before lovemaking. Infinitely superior to the diaphragm is the cervical cap, if you can use it. And I know people who do successfully use it. And I think it is not impossible that you'll be able to get custom-made diaphragms that are actually so closely molded to the shape of the cervix that they have a positive fit. And they also could be disposable. You could be given a set for a year, you know, and so on and so forth. We could improve the barrier methods, but who is going to do it?
What about condoms for men?
I'm very much in favor of them, especially for young people. I mean, the problem with young people is that they desperately need a barrier method for 100 reasons, because they cannot take the pill. It looks as if it is severely counterindicated for 16, 17-year-olds, 14, 15-year-olds, because they're in an experimental phase of sex, because of the exposure to now a host of sexually transmitted diseases, not just the two biggies, but all the others that turn out to be more damaging even than gonorrhea. So what makes me smile bitterly is that we know we have a problem with our kids from the rate of juvenile pregnancy and juvenile disease. And they're our kids. They're our problem. They're not 800 million Indians doing heaven knows what on the other side of the world. They're our kids and they're suffering. And our technology is failing to help them. We cannot sell them a solution as simple as the condom. They will not accept it from us. We have so little continuity between our cultures. In England at the moment, we're trying to popularize the condom with a pathetic television advertisement, which has a very elderly rock star saying, you know, you don't have to get a girl pregnant, blokes, you know, you just use this little thing. And we daren't mention it. The kids who watch it must wonder what on earth we're actually talking about, because we're much too modest to say, you know, see this here, this is a condom. And my idea is, you know, if only Boy George would walk through the air terminals of the world scattering coloured condoms from his clothing, if only Michael Jackson would appear in a video clad in nothing but a condom, maybe we'd be able to do it. If only the Fonz had condoms in his wallet. But he didn't. Now the Fonz has become Henry Winkler and we're making films about juvenile alcoholism. Maybe he'll think of a way to make a film about condoms. For the kids, I think they're the best answer.
Feminist writers have for years said that one of the most important things in enabling a woman to be independent is allowing her to control her own fertility. And you're saying, I think, that the next step in controlling fertility is to redefine sex so that it's not just sexual intercourse that requires either birth control or leaves the possibility of pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, but I think we should, instead of suppressing our fertility as a shameful thing that became kind of obscene, we should become proud of our fertility and difficult about it. You know, we should protect it jealously. Mine was destroyed by the sort of series of insults and accidents to my reproductive faculty that I describe as being the most typical form of sterility in our society, the rising index of this kind of sterility. And I figure that if I had not been so hasty about obliterating, I never had very much, it turned out. But the funny thing about pill culture, of course, is that we take the pill without knowing whether we're fertile or not. So we'll never know how fertile I was to start with. But if I had been more jealous of my fertility and more proud of it, if I hadn't been so cavalier, I probably would not be in this situation now. And it's not a situation that fills me with bitterness or despair or anything. But, you know, maybe a kid would have had a good time with me. And as it is, we'll never find out, you know. And I figure that if our young women take a different attitude, if they become proud of the integrity of their bodies, we went through the whole phase of conquering the right to sexual activity. Now we're going to get difficult again, I think. I think there are some signs that we are getting difficult again. It's not so easy to pick up women as it used to be.
Well, what kind of reaction have you gotten from women of different generations to what you're suggesting?
Oh, fantastic, actually. I've had all kinds... The reactions that matter to me are not the reactions of the professional hacks who write a review every month, you know, and they've got to think of something to say, because those reactions are in many ways synthetic. The reactions that matter to me are the reactions of people who've never written a letter to a public figure before and who write and say, look, I'd just like you to know that I was ashamed of myself because all through my married life I couldn't use any of the stuff other people used, and my husband and I sorted it out with coitus interruptus, and everything we read about it told us that we were doing something dangerous and evil, and I'm relieved to know I'm not going crazy, you know, and I'm not going to go crazy, and I haven't committed a series of terrible sins against myself. You'd be amazed how many of that sort of letter there is. Letters from very old ladies. And one woman sent me a wonderful letter describing how her husband made love to her. Letters from midwives saying, thank God somebody said it because we're going nuts here trying to help these women. The people who write and say, you know, you're a godless whore and you've... I mean, people have written sort of letters that say, you nagged at us for years about how we should all be feminists and we should all be jumping on every man that came into the room, and now you're nagging at us again to tell us to stop. The first is not true, and the second is not true either.
Do you think that a lot of people feel that the only really authentic form of sex is intercourse, and that if they're doing it another way, that even if it feels good, that they're cheating themselves, and that if they were being studied or something, that they wouldn't measure up, that they wouldn't be doing the real thing?
I do. I'm afraid I think that very strongly, and I think it even more when sex education in schools enters the picture. I don't see how they'll do it without imparting an idea of normality, of, you know, orthodoxy. It is that we do actually have what I call sex religion. Your orgasm is your duty to yourself. And you're even told what kind of orgasm you should have. And you're even told that if you're not having them, there's something wrong with you. And you're asked to go to a guru or someone. And I think I don't actually identify closely with Thomas Sasse, who's much keener on American institutions than I am, possibly because of his different background. But I think in his critique of the hypocrisy and the ballyhoo and the absurdity of the proselytizing about sex therapy, he's following the path of total common sense. It is gross and ridiculous.
My guest is Germaine Greer, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, Sex and Destiny. A lot of the popular magazines have an article every 2 months about how to make your sex life more interesting if it's gotten dull. And the assumption is, by the volume of these articles, that a lot of people are really dissatisfied with their sex lives with their partners, and that they have to dream up new fantasies or buy new implements or clothes to make sex interesting again. What do you think that means?
Well, I think it's really all part of the way in which sex became the principal parlor game, the principal diversion of our bureaucratic society. Bureaucracies historically have always permitted sexual activity of one form or another. Soldiers, the army is the best example. Soldiers are allowed to have all kinds of sexual activity. They're assumed to need it. Wherever they go, resort to prostitutes is assumed. And so, you know, and our society is a bit the same. We're not allowed to make families, just like soldiers. We can't build up clans because they compete with the governing bureaucracy for power. They tend to be impervious to the law. They tend to be totally self-interested and so on. Now, when sexual activity was being recommended to us, when we got a license to practice it, and we're positively urged to practice it by massive things like the whole Playboy culture, the Playboy philosophy, and so on. That was just extending this pattern, in my view. And it was pretty obvious that we'd soon run out of interest. Now, what that would lead to in many cases is serial monogamy, men would dump the stimulus that had ceased to work and get themselves a nice new stimulus. And this would be very expensive because this would mean that their consumption was going to increase exponentially because they're going to have to maintain one lot and then they have to maintain the next lot. How many cars do they buy in this kind of family? How many refrigerators? You know, and so it went on. This sort of, and the actual impedimenta of sexual entertainment. I mean, sex is the staple of all our cultural entertainment, even our religious entertainment.
Explain.
Well, the marketing of the television evangelists. I mean, if you actually look at it coldly, look at it like a Martian, strip your mind of every expectation, look at the way they sing their songs, look at the way they talk, the soft caressing voices, the subliminal message is one of seduction. And what comes out is instant gratification, the whole idea of being born again. You know, there I was hanging the clothes on the line and whammo, I suddenly felt God, you know. And even though, I mean, there may be some elements of discipline, although they're not evident. I mean, the doctrine that is taught is an instant pabulum. It's not anything taxing or difficult. They don't teach you any philosophy or anything that might actually make your brain bones ache, you know. All of that. It's all instant gratification, instant gratification. And, of course, people ran to the end of that tether. It doesn't go very far. And then they had to start asking, well, we no sooner got the right to have the penis than we found we had to have the vibrator because the penis couldn't hack it, you know. And we ran to the end of our mythic potency. It turns out there is a limit to human libido. In fact, libido must be, I think, quite artfully husbanded in order to function properly. It won't unjam the circuits if you keep fiddling with it. And what they keep telling us to do is to keep fiddling with it. That's the idea. You've got to keep it regularly oiled. It shouldn't squeak, you know. And I find the whole thing sad. I mean, I know cultures where there are no pictures of tight jeans on television and no billboards showing, you know, suntanned bodies with bottles of suntan oil by them and so forth, where there is sex in the air, where you simply don't play fast and loose with people's bodies. You don't encourage intimacy because you're aware of each other as having this tremendous power. It is not true that modest societies are actually repressed sexuality. The Protestant societies did it in a very special way because they made us do it within ourselves. So nice girls don't. We were allowed to be with men, but we weren't expected to feel anything, and we obliged by not feeling very much. But there are societies where people imagine that if you take your eye off a woman, she will instantly do something explosive and sexual. And I find them less depressing. That was something I learned in Sicily, actually. All these dark girls who sat quietly doing their crochet, they did look up and catch a man's eye. The effect was electric. You wouldn't get it in a singles bar, I tell you. It was, everybody was sort of mentally on the qui vive. They were sexually alive to each other. Every word had a sexual connotation.
Society has changed a lot since you wrote your first book. I mean,
sort of,
yeah. But cultures tend to just, you know, change every decade in various ways. But you've changed in the sense that you're older now. You're 14 years older mm-hmm. than the time of the publication of your first book. Do you find that age is changing at all your philosophical views of sexuality?
No, I don't know. We went through a terrible time, you know. About the time that The Female Eunuch was published, I was working as a practicing pornographer because I thought the only way to deal with sadistic pornography, and I regard a paper like Screw, for example, as sadistic pornography, as its title implies, was to try a form of non-sadistic pornography. And I was involved with various sort of alternative society activities, in the course of which I was covered with opprobrium, because I was trying to break out of this Screw mold, you see. We went to the Wet Dream Film Festival. I was a judge at the second Wet Dream Film Festival, and I invented a marking system, which I got them to accept, because I knew that I was going to give all my votes to one film by Jean Genet that had no women in it at all, and actually no intromission in it at all, that was about men in prison trying to make love to each other through the stone walls. I mean, it's a marvelous allegory of sexual activity in our society, because all they were capable of doing was a little bit of self-gratification. It was all masturbation, really. And I still think that all our sex is a search for individual gratification. We don't know how to make love to each other. I mean, Italians who've grown up in a society which is very pro-lovemaking, pro-caressing, pro-words, Italians talk their way into your bed, have a different attitude altogether. But in this film, there was a wonderful sequence where one of the men who's desperately sort of rubbing himself up against the wall and trying to talk to the man in the next cell has a cigarette. And he takes a puff of his cigarette and he blows the smoke through the wall, goes through a tiny crevice, and the man on the other side inhales this faint shadow of true love, which has nothing whatever to do with their genital contact or anything. It's a fabulous film. It looks pretty terrible. There aren't very many prints around. I gave all my marks to this film. Oh, my God. You know, I got reviled by Goldstein. Everybody, look at her, artsy, fartsy, sanctimonious, pietistic, bleh. But I knew exactly what I was doing. And I was on my own. Nobody knew what my idea of sexuality was. It was too spiritual. I mean, they were never going to know. And I think it's typically feminist idea of sexuality. And then we got into worse trouble. I mean, we were all right in the forefront. I mean, I had taken of myself the most obscene picture that has ever been taken of a woman anywhere. And it was run in this paper as a full page spread, which was part of a long misunderstanding for which I eventually left them. You can't work with men, is my view. They really can't help ripping you off, and they ripped me off in this case. They just couldn't help it. They knew I would go, and they knew when I went the paper would collapse, but they still couldn't help it. It was too bigger. It was a vicarious rape that they could carry out with total impunity, and they did it. We got into trouble with a man who was doing a stage act and was going to kill a goose and put his member inside the goose. And the act had been full of urination and defecation and abuse and cruelty, and someone had had a rolling pin inserted in him. And the climax was to be the murder of this goose. And I was saying, no, no, no. If we watch this, we will all be polluted by it. I'm not having it. And everyone said, no, no, we don't believe in censorship. You've got to let them do it. We're discovering about ourselves. I think there's some things about myself I don't want to discover, maybe. And the moment came when he held up the goose before the ceremonial murder. Just before that, he'd crawled out in German, "Soll niemand mein Schwanz steif machen?" Will nobody make my member stiff? And I just called back, "Niemand soll nie dein Schwanz steif machen." No one will ever. And he held up the goose before he was going to kill it, in this horrible sort of sex art display. And the goose, beautiful grey-eyed goose, it was the most terrible moment. The goose was thirsty, and it could feel the water vapour from his breath, so it put its head down and laid its beak against his lips, and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to die! I mean, I was about to burst. And then Heathcote Williams, who's a slight man, a great poet, the man who wrote AC/DC, do you ever hear? It's the only good hippie artwork that was ever, hippie work of art, I think, is the play AC/DC. Well, Heathcote shot into the air. The man was standing on a stage that was about waist height. He was much taller than the Heathcote, and he was holding the goose right above his head. And somehow, just as if he'd been shot out of a trap, Heathcote just shot into the air and grabbed the goose. And Muir wasn't expecting this character. And Heathcote tore out of the auditorium. Well, Heathcote didn't tear, I'm lying. Heathcote fell down. He jumped up too high, which meant he couldn't keep his balance. He fell. And somebody else grabbed the goose from him while the bouncers from the club that we were all in turned around and started kicking Heathcote. And then the other guy ran out of the building and ran all the way down the Gracht until he came to a barge and shoved the goose at the barge man and said, "Keep it." And the goose sailed off down the canal on the barge. Back at the ranch, everybody's going on about this was a disgraceful interference with a great artist's work and blah, blah, blah. Heathcote was sobbing his eyes out, and his girlfriend, who was Jean Shrimpton, beautiful model with cornflower blue eyes, was protecting him like savagely, like a harpy, not letting anyone get near him. He was just curled up, sobbing, sobbing, sobbing. And other people were saying, "Well, gee, I thought he really got us going there. You know, we were turned off, you know, and he got us all excited. It was great energy there," and all that kind of jargon. And I thought to myself, "That's it. If this is sexual revolution, you can keep it." It has nothing to do with what I want. What I want, what I wanted, what I still want, was that something like the reconquest of innocence, the reconquest of children's sexuality, which involves all of them, their hearts, their minds, their lungs, their toenails. I want to go back to something like that and to stop tinkering with parts and confusing it with defecation and humiliation and exercise of power, and to escape from the specter of our own impotence. I think we're still caught in the cycle of impotence.
So was that incident it for you? Did you leave the sex world after that?
Yes. Well, no, I think... No, I went on with the polemic. I went on writing. And in fact, we'll republish those articles and all of that because I was bitterly angry about that.
You should explain what you mean by a child's sexuality.
Well, I mean, it's whole body eroticism. And it's extremely potent. Children are very tender, little girls and little boys, very tender, very seductive, utterly passionate lovers. It's the most astonishing love affair that children have, for their mothers especially.
You're not talking about pedophilia?
No. No, no. You see, one of the things I find so interesting is that we think that there has to be a genital component in every relationship. So if you discover that really men are not your companions, and you frequent the society of women, you become a woman among women, we assume that you also apply to women for your genital satisfaction because we assume that that everybody's a couple. And I say, I reject that emphatically. Human beings are not meant to be part of couples. I won't take all that Platonist nonsense. I'm looking for the other half of me. That's not right. We are all selves and we are all members of groups. And those groups are protean. They change all the time. So I can't see why your lover must also be your best friend. I don't know why your lover can't be your lover and your best friend can't be your best friend, you know? And it's this constant thing. I mean, I want the society of children. I want to cuddle them. I want to sleep with them. I want to teach them everything. I want to teach them music. I want to take them swimming. I mean, teaching a child swimming is a profoundly erotic experience. But I don't want to rub my genitals on them or make them touch me or touch theirs particularly. I have, in fact. I mean, I gave the example in the book. Mothers taking baby boys' penises in their mouths to stop them crying, an activity which is not regarded as perverse or anything else.
Who does that?
It happens to work. Some women in southern Italy used to do it. I mean, I don't know if they still do it. They're probably being subject to too much propaganda. I can remember once my little godchild who had colic and screamed her head off for every night for the first 3 months of her life. I remember once she was screaming, 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 and I just wanted to see if there was any way I could stop her screaming. We'd done absolutely everything, and I remember kissing her on her mons pubis, and she sort of stopped for a split second with a sort of interested look on her face, and then went straight back to screaming again. I didn't go any further particularly because I wasn't sure about the wisdom of it, because in fact, with babies normally, I mean, every contact is erotic. Mothers in India rub their babies with oil for a long time. It's a long whole body massage because they're very anxious to make them supple and long. And they pull out all their little joints and all their little articulations and all the wonderful rub, rub, rub with the fingers. And the baby is sort of, oh, great. In Maharashtra, they rub them with mustard oil and mango juice and turmeric and things like that because they want their skin to be golden. Their skin is golden. But, I mean, there are all these ritual activities to keep it golden. It would have stayed golden anyway. But the whole thing is great, this incredible contact. And the mother looks into the child's eyes while she does this, you know. It's in a huge relationship. And what we do, what growing up in our society is, we impoverish it. We make it become more and more dreary and dull and circumspect and dangerous.
Even people who don't know your books, who know the titles but haven't really read them, know that you've written a lot about sexuality. What are some of the stereotypes that you think people have of you that you think are not true, that you encounter when you meet strangers who know the name but don't know you and don't really know your writing?
Oh, gosh, I try not to spend too much time thinking about that. You see, there's been so much silliness going on lately. There was David Plant's book, which is a raid upon my privacy and my integrity, which I disapprove of. But it's none of it is quite right, because David's got the worst memory of anyone I've ever met. He can never remember who said what to whom or who's up whom or for how much or any of that. He gets it all wrong. But some aspects of the way that I live, I think he's probably rendered in a more or less accurate way. It's true that I, you know, fought censorship for years and years and still do. I would never join an anti-pornography demonstration. I would never indulge in, I would never cry for punitive attacks on the purveyors of pornography. I despise them, but I'll fight them my way. I won't put them in prison or anything like that. People now say, you know, you're one of the people who started the sexual revolution. You told women to do this and that. I mean, women were being more sexually active. It's really got nothing to do with what I said to be. And what I was really concerned about was to say to women, whatever you do, you did it. It's not, don't behave as if life is forced on you. Don't think of yourself as promiscuous, because the word is a lie. The word means you haven't exercised any choice. If you take 50 lovers, provided you took them all and were not taken by them, you are not promiscuous. So do what you will. I hate to be confused with Ayn Rand, but you know what I mean.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure, ma'am.